Future. I'm Robin Daly, Chairman and Founder of the UK's integrative cancer care charity, Yes to Life. I'm currently running a series of shows that focus on our forthcoming book, The Cancer Revolution. Its author is Patricia Peat of Cancer Options, but she's aided and abetted by 37 international experts, some of whom I'm speaking to in these shows, to give you a sense of the astounding level of combined expertise that's gone into the book. This week's show is homing in on the detox section of the book and features two writers coming at the problems from very different angles. First in, I'm talking over Skype to Janie Lee Grace, author, broadcaster, and advocate of all things non-toxic for the home. Hi Janie, thanks a lot for coming on the show today.
No worries, thank you very much for having me.
And over and above that, thanks so much for contributing a very important chapter to the detoxification section of The Cancer Revolution. I'm really delighted that you agreed to contribute what's a really practical chapter to go into the detox section of the book. It's about addressing the myriad ways that we, usually unwittingly, expose ourselves to toxins day in, day out, right in our own homes. At this point, most people are aware about how unhealthy the air is out on the street, with figures well up around 30,000 per annum for premature deaths from pollution. And even those figures are claimed to be a gross underestimate. But you start off your chapter by saying that, in fact, the levels of toxins are actually often higher in our own homes than they are out on the street. Really? Mm. Well, how come?
Well, I know it does seem bizarre, doesn't it? But the truth of it is, you know, the levels of pollution are high outside, of course. And to a certain extent, there's not an awful lot we can do about that. We can't make those choices. Within our own home, we absolutely can. And the really difficult thing is that unless we're lucky enough to be able to live in a purpose-built eco home with everything completely natural and, you know, jute floorings and organic fabrics and everything else, then for most of us, the infrastructure of our home is going to be causing some kinds of pollution. But then what we then bring in is going to compound those effects.
Right.
So, you know, we might have a dodgy old boiler system. We might have MDF. We might have all kinds of, you know, old carpets. We might have all kinds of stuff that's giving off gases and goodness knows what. And to a certain extent, you know, we can cope with most of that. But when you then compound that by bringing in literally thousands of potentially toxic chemicals, literally thousands, that's when you start to find yourself swimming in a kind of toxic soup. Although, of course, most of us don't realize it until it's pointed out. And I mean, one thing I think it's important to stress is that people will often say to me, oh, I've heard you speak and I've heard you talk about the problems with everything from washing up liquid to air freshener, but my mum's all right or my grandma's all right and they live till 100 and they definitely use bleach in their loo. And you know, they'll say something like that. And my answer will be, well, you know what, you're probably right. Because, you know, you're absolutely right. They would have had some regular washing up liquid. They would have had some bleach for the loo. They may have even had an air freshener. But that would have been it. Hmm. And they would have absolutely opened their windows. They wouldn't have lived in, you know, centrally heated, locked into centrally heated homes, you know, not allowing anything to escape. And you know, when I say that would have been it would have been the kind of the 2-3 bottles of something under the sink. And then they'd use bicarbonate of soda and that good old fashioned ingredient that we've forgotten about called elbow grease. Mm-hmm. Whereas in the average kitchen now, if you open, you know, if you look under the sink, there's about 50 things, literally.
Yeah, you know?
And then another 50 in the bathroom, of course.
Yeah. So, yes, you're right. Things have escalated in a way which, I mean, you need to see it on paper to believe it, really, in terms of the introduction of chemicals into the environment generally, and particularly, as you say, into our homes. It's run away, isn't it? And you're right, yeah. In earlier generations, they always used some nasty stuff, but it wasn't in everything. You know?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's something like, don't quote me on this figure exactly because it's a guesstimate, but it's in the region of 100,000 different synthetic chemicals passed safe for use. Yeah. Now, of course, we could get into the argument of whether they all really are safe, but let's assume for one moment they are. They're passed safe for use individually. So they've been tested individually, and somebody somewhere has said, yeah, that's okay to use that synthetic chemical. However, what they can't test is what happens when they interact. with other chemicals, because that's an equation that it's not possible to do. Although, interestingly, the Ecologist magazine once said they could do it, but it would take 200 years. And let's face it, who's going to fund that study? So the issue isn't necessarily the one bottle of anything. The issue is the interreaction between literally hundreds of thousands of different chemicals. And maybe they're left in sunlight, maybe they're the mix is not great. We know that when certain chemicals interact, they can become carcinogenic. And so if you've only got one bottle of something, you're probably going to be fine. Yeah. But if you've got 50, 60, 100 bottles, tubes, containers, then you can, it's easy to see how you're compounding the effects of so many different chemicals, and particularly fragrances. Fragrances are really, in my opinion, the bad guys, because artificial fragrance, we know, is extremely bad for our respiratory system, all kinds of issues with artificial fragrance. And again, if it was just a few drops of something in one bottle, I'm sure we could cope with it. But when it's in everything, literally everything, and by the way, a manufacturer only has to write the word parfum or fragrance on the back of something, but they can have added many, you know, large quantities of different synthetic chemicals. They don't have to specify the amounts.
Yeah, well, you're right. We're kind of making ourselves into sort of experimental guinea pigs by spraying all this stuff around our homes, aren't we, as to what happens when they all mix together.
Yeah.
Scary. So anyway, I describe your contribution as practical because it unravels all the complexities of an under-sink cupboard crammed with an arsenal of different chemicals for every conceivable bit of your home. But you set out some simple, cheap, non-toxic, multi-purpose solutions to this, fortunately. Well, can you say just a little bit about the kind of Technicolor display in the cleaning aisle of the supermarket and why we should consider rethinking our cleaning and the personal care, of course, as you point out. And, you know, what we're going to purchase, and especially if we have cancer.
Yeah. Well, I would really honestly urge anybody to think about this. Let's start with cleaning products, because this is an area where if you're currently buying conventional cleaning products, the really great news is not only, you know, it really is a win-win, because if you opt for the natural approach, you will save money, you will do a great benefit to the planet, you won't be harming the planet, and of course it's the environment is going to be much healthier for you. And the really good news is you do not have to throw a load of money at this. There are different ways of doing it, but one of the easiest ways is to just think old style. Literally think back to the 1950s and right. Think, okay, let's get some bicarbonate soda. I mean, interestingly, it used to be even cheaper than it is now. I think the manufacturers read one of my books and made it more expensive because it used to be super cheap, but it still is cheap enough. So get a load of bicarbonate soda. There's not much you can't do with a half a cup of bicarbonate soda and water and a microfiber cloth. They are, of course, you know, an amazing new invention that I wouldn't want to go back to the 50s and live without. So any microfiber cloth is brilliant. In fact, with many microfiber cloths, you don't need any detergent at all. We all forget that. You just need water. That's actually all you need. And then things like, as I say, bicarbonate of soda is absolutely brilliant for cleaning plastics, although there's a discussion for another time because obviously we would like to avoid as much plastic as possible. But when you do need to clean out things like whatever it is that you have that's plastic, whether it's jugs or whatever, things like coffee pots, all of that stuff, bicarbonate soda is amazing. It's an absolutely amazing wonder thing. And then so is vinegar. Now, you know, a thing of vinegar is 20p in a supermarket. If you can get white vinegar, it doesn't smell quite as strong. It's a bit more expensive, but you really don't need it. And again, vinegar will clean just about anything. You can make a little fizzing solution of vinegar and bicarbonate soda if you want to clean your drains or something a little hard, you know, a little more robust for the loo. And then for people who are thinking, oh, wait a minute, you know, what about I need something antibacterial. Well, interestingly, I'm very antibacterials because I think one of the main problems we have for ourselves now is we're all depleted in terms of our gut health. And largely that is because we're not replacing good, you know, we don't have good bacteria there. And it's been swept away by the overuse of antibiotics and antibacterial products. And this is one of the main reasons why, you know, it can be so difficult to keep your immune system up, particularly if you're unwell. So by ditching the antibacterials, you'll be really doing yourself a very big favor. And the truth of it is, you don't need antibacterial anything. You really don't. If you feel as though, oh, I could clean the loose seat, I've kind of got to use something, then use one drop of tea tree oil on a microfiber cloth will do the same job. You know, that's naturally antibacterial. And there's lots of things like that, lots of recipes in my chapter and in my books where you can just go up, think old style, and get this job done without using any of this stuff. When it comes to laundry, again, that's an area where people spend a fortune, potentially very toxic products. And I would say nobody, absolutely nobody ever needs to use fabric softener. Don't even think about it. You don't need it. Don't use any of that stuff you spray on your clothes. You really don't need it. You can wash your clothes in soap nuts or eco balls. They're fantastically cheap. They're brilliant for colored, general sort of colored clothing because they don't bleach out the clothing. They're not harsh, so you don't need any softener because you've not used anything harsh to start with. So they're really, really cheap ways. If you don't fancy that, if that feels too difficult for you, then you can invest a little bit more in one of the more natural brands of laundry detergent or old style laundry bleach. And the same with the cleaning. Actually, one company that I'd love to recommend, not because I'm on commission for their products, I'm not, but they're called Mangel & Ringer. And they're a fantastic company. They're amazing because all their recipes come from a traditional housekeeper, wartime housekeeper. And she passed down these recipes. So their products are literally like the DIY products, but they arrive beautifully packaged. So if you don't want to be, you know, stand and mix your own, then, you know, the products are lovely. And there's also a laundry bleach. A laundry powder and even a laundry bleach. So if you've got white clothes, and then you can have a more natural way of making them look sparkling and lovely.
Fantastic. Great. Well, I love the fact you described that as a being win-win, these kind of approaches, because actually I use that phrase in the introduction in the book because that's true of so much of this kind of move away from synthetic approaches and to natural approaches. It's a win for everybody because of the effect it has on the environment, of course.
Yeah,
it's brilliant. And the publishing company that's publishing the book is also called Win-Win. So we've gone for that phrase. Anyway, so whilst being careful to point out that you're no kind of expert on the subject, you do express great reservations about the levels of electromagnetic fields, or EMFs, that are now encountered in most homes. Would you like to say why and what kind of straightforward strategies you suggest for reducing them?
Yeah, I mean, this really is a massive topic and you know, I've only really scratched the surface of it. My feeling is that we know about pollution. We've known about pollution for a long time, but it's only in more recent years that we have this different kind of pollution, this electro pollution, if you like. And it's absolutely ridiculous to say that it won't be having any effect on us. Of course it's having an effect on us. I mean, it's not difficult to notice how, you know, you go and stand by a waterfall, you know, you feel amazing. There's something amazing about you know, the negative ions in that sort of situation. And you compare that to being in an office where literally everything is buzzing. It's literally buzzing. It's not just sort of, you know, it's buzzing, but of course you do. Now, you know, of course I'm not saying I want to just kind of run off to the hills and you know, be on a mountainside and not ever use a mobile phone. I mean, we can't go back. I appreciate we can't go back. All we can really do is limit our exposure a little bit, and particularly for children, I'm very hot on this because their, you know, their skulls are thinner and the you know, the problem is going to get to them quicker. But I think for all of us, what we can do is just tiny little things that might contribute a little bit towards, you know, supporting our immunity a little more. And they really are a drop in the ocean or a sort of sticking plaster on a huge problem. But to my mind, it's almost a case of, well, if it doesn't really cost you much to do this, why not just do it anyway? You may as well. So they're very, very basic and general tips. Let's start with the really simple ones, which are get the right houseplants. Now, houseplants are just amazing. Certain houseplants will soak up pollution for you, you know, including electro pollution. I mean, The humble peace lily, you know, with a beautiful plant anyway, not expensive, will soak up formaldehyde, for example, to a tune of 30 feet. Now, even NASA scientists know this. NASA scientists use the right houseplants because they know that they have this amazing effect. The humble spider plant, I mean, they don't even need to be talked to, do they?
No.
They don't even need much love. But, you know, the theory says if you have these houseplants, particularly have them near to your electrical equipment. Now, of course, that might mean in some home offices it starts to look like Kew Gardens, but you know what? They do say have one for every bit of electronic equipment.
Okay.
Now, if that means your home or your office is going to start to look like a jungle, well, you might want to stop and think, oh, I wonder if I can get rid of one of these devices.
Right.
You know, often we can't. But literally, have as many houseplants, of these kind of houseplants, as you possibly can. That's a very simple suggestion. And then there's, you know, obvious things like turn off Wi-Fi at night. That's if you're going to have Wi-Fi at all. I mean, we don't. We have the DLAN plugs. We're hardwired. And we have this kind of things that plug in,
mm-hmm.
so that it's not constantly flying around. But if you do have Wi-Fi, and I fully appreciate that many people do, and if you live in close quarters to somebody else, it'll be coming through the wall anyway. But do the best you can to turn that off at night. Just get restorative sleep. I'm a really big believer that for most of us, we can cope with some stuff being thrown at us, you know, but when our immunity gets really low is when we're not getting restorative sleep, which is why, by the way, I'm so furious that so many hospitals, you know, where people are sickest of all, have got phone masks on the flipping roof. I mean, it's just unbelievable. Anyway, you know, as I say, there's not a lot we can do about that. We can only do the bits we can for ourselves. So turn your Wi-Fi off at night. Do not sleep with your mobile phone by your bed. And the amount of people that use their phone as an alarm clock, just get an alarm clock, please.
Right.
Just don't sleep with you. In fact, don't have any electrical equipment in your bedroom. You really, the bedroom should be for, you know, sleep, basically. And it really should not be looking at screens. In fact, lots of scientific evidence that show if you look at screens, you're going to have less, you know, your sleep is not going to be as good. So it's a really good idea to keep screens out of the bedroom, not just for children, adults as well. Other very simple ideas include wearing something that's a protective device for you that will help strengthen your immunity. It can't stop the radiation from the phones, can't do that, but it can help strengthen your immunity. And there are lots of products on the market now that can help with that. I'm a really big fan of the Well Balancers. The company are called Well Balancer. They're fantastic. Again, they can't stop the radiation, but they can help boost your immunity. Cheap, effective. You can wear a pendant or a bangle, or there's key fobs. There's all kinds of things. There's another company called Bioprotective Systems who make home harmonizers. So that's another way of you know, hopefully harmonizing areas of your home, particularly if you know you live near transmitters and that kind of thing. So these are really little suggestions. And when it comes to your mobile phone, have a protective device on your mobile phone as well.
By that you mean?
Again, there's several companies. There's one called Energy Dots. There's a company called Phone Shield, where you can just literally stick a little thing on the back of your phone. I mean, we're talking, I don't know, 15, 20, 25 quid kind of price, you know. So these aren't expensive. But do your bit as well, i.e. be hands-free as much as possible. Don't be on your mobile for an hour. It's a really bad idea because we don't know. I mean, I would really suggest that this is an area where people do their own research and they go and read as much as they can on this subject. Dr. Roger Coghill is a great source of information here. Many years ago, before anyone else was talking about it, he wrote a book called Something in the Air. He's a very interesting character. So it's a really good idea to do some research. But, you know, all of this comes down to the same thing, really, which is, okay, there's lots of stuff I can't change. I can't change the mobile phone mast outside my door. I can't change the fact that, you know, everyone has got Wi-Fi. I mean, some whole towns are Wi-Fi'd up. I can't change the pollution from vehicles or whatever it might be. What can I change? Here's what I can change. I can easily change what I choose to buy, you know, and to do in my own home. That's what I can change.
Well, that's brilliant. And I really like the point you brought up about the fact that actually we can cope with a certain amount. We're actually built for it. You know, we're built to, there are toxins in the environment anyway.
Of course.
And so the body has an immune system. It has ways of detoxification. And so we are built for this, but it's when one of two things happens. Either we don't look after ourselves properly, and so our immune system goes down, or we just simply overwhelm it with far too much crap, you know. And
Absolutely. So it's
very important to keep the balance right if we want to stay healthier. And then, you know, I think if we keep ourselves in good shape, a lot of the things you can't change, as you say, you can actually get through them without suffering too much.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, onto the sort of personal care products as well.
Yes.
I mean, I think they're hugely important. And of course, you really do have a say in that, even if you don't. I mean, if you live with someone else, perhaps you may not have a say in every single element of the cleaning of the home. But when it comes to your personal care products, every one of us can make a choice there. And this is an area where, again, it's changed over the years, because again, people will say, oh, well, my mum used to have some cold cream and a red lipstick and she's okay. Yeah, and again, that would have been it, you know, a couple of things. Now it's sort of 55 things in the bathroom cabinet and another 10 in your toiletry bag that you take away or whatever it is, and for women another 25 in your makeup bag. And it's absolutely unnecessary to have this amount of stuff. You just don't need it. You can massively simplify what you use, and you can, I genuinely believe I've found a natural alternative to absolutely everything. And that doesn't mean you can't wear makeup. My book's called Look Great Naturally Without Ditching the Lipstick.
Yes.
You know, you don't actually have to sacrifice anything. You can do anything you did before, but you can do it using a natural approach. And again, with skincare, it's another great way to have that win-win. You spend less. In fact, many things can be completely DIY. You can just whisk them up from what you've got in your kitchen. It definitely will benefit the planet if you're not pushing all that stuff down the sink, you know, every time you shower, and you'll feel better because you're not surrounding yourself in these toxins. So, you know, on that note, I would say, very, very simple recipes for skincare. You can make yourself just a little exfoliating wash. Just a bit of oatmeal with water will give it a little exfoliating wash. You can make a sort of face mask, add a little bit of honey, or add some salt if you want it to be exfoliating. So really simple ways of getting of really cleansing your face well. Soap, by the way, don't ever use conventional regular soap. It's absolutely rubbish. You need proper soap. Proper soap. And in fact, the supermarkets in the UK have just are now stocking what was the first organic range of soap. So that's very affordable. That's from the Little Soap Company. And that is proper soap. Yeah. Artisan soap, proper soap. None of this nonsense and artificial fragrance added. So if you want to use soap, then, you know, that's a good way to go. Oils are fantastic. If you want to moisturize your skin, I mean, in an ideal world, we wouldn't need to, would we? But the truth of it is, because of pollution and because of being in environments with lots of central heating, we do need to rehydrate our skin. And one of the best ways is oils. Oils are just amazing because they rehydrate the lipidic film of the skin. Now, you can throw money at it and buy beautiful facial oils. There are lots and lots on the market, but it's super easy to make your own, super easy. You just need a base oil of something like jojoba oil or grapeseed oil, and then you add a couple of drops of essential oil. And the great thing there is you can tailor it to how you're feeling. So if you've got a cold coming on, just make yourself a little mix with a bit of eucalyptus in, and then you've got the benefits of the aromatherapy as well. Shampoos, aftershaves, all of these things, you can get a natural version. Get the most natural you can find. And when it comes to products, by the way, my top tip is, with anything linked to skincare and beauty products, don't look for what's in the product, because you'll find many products that contain, you might get something that says, contains organic aloe vera. So you'll be thinking, oh, wow, that sounds good. Or contains chamomile. Oh, chamomile's good. I'll have that one. Yes, it might contain something really nice. What you need to look at is what else is in it. So look for what's not in the product. And the companies who really do care about this, who are really ethical, will make it very clear. They will make it clear in their packaging that their products don't contain all the usual suspects. They don't contain sodium lauryl sulfates, parabens, preservatives, artificial fragrances, and all of the rest of it. If anyone's already feeling overwhelmed, by the way, the quickest way to start is choose a natural deodorant. Just go for a natural deodorant, because you'll find it so cheap, so effective, you won't have to replace it for a year, and you'll think, wow, what have I been doing all this time?
start small. I think it's really important what you say there about the fact that actually there's very few brands out there that actually you can really trust, and they, you know, you can trust them because, of course, their whole ethos is the fact that they don't include these things and they shout about it. Mm. And yeah, you have to choose carefully.
Mm. Well, I'd disagree with you there, actually, because I think now there's masses more. When I wrote my first book 10 years ago, there was only, you could count on one hand, certainly the makeup companies, and probably two hands, the really, really genuine skincare companies. But I think the market has grown massively.
Well,
you do have to be careful, you know.
Yeah.
It is really good news. There now really is, you know, a wealth of choice for people who want to buy completely natural products. And hopefully that's where I come in, because I've done the work for you. So lots of that is on my website, lots of the things that I've really looked into and can genuinely recommend.
Great. Well, I should be putting the links, of course, to your website and all that to go with the show. So fantastic. All right. Well, look. Thanks so much, as I say again, for contributing a great chapter to the book. Loads of really helpful practical information in there along the lines you've just been sharing now. And brilliant again to talk to you today.
Yeah, great. Thank you. Wish you every success with it.
Thank you, Jenny.
Thanks a lot.
Next up is Dr. Robert Verkerk, passionate environmental scientist and founder of the Alliance for Natural Health, a crucial campaigning organisation. I visited the ANH at their offices in Dorking to talk to Rob about his contribution to the book. Brilliant to have you back on the show again, Rob, and a major thank you for generously contributing to the cancer revolution. So your chapter gives us a tour de force coverage of the myriad ways in which our environment is now a hazard to our health, along with a great many strategies for reducing our exposure and mitigating our risk. So, out of necessity, you don't go into great depth on anything, but as a reader, you can't help but get the impression that it's all very overwhelming. The establishment views always dismiss toxins. This is apart from a few major exceptions like tobacco and asbestos, but it's largely dismissed toxins as important in causing cancer. But slowly, slowly, their role is becoming established. So how much do you think environmental factors contribute to the spiralling cancer incidence?
Well, the bottom line, Robin, it's great to be back on, but the bottom line is that no one is really in an absolutely authoritative position. You know, if you go back to the Richard Doll list, we saw a handful mm-hmm. of particular carcinogens. We've seen now the International Agency for Research on Cancer developing a bigger list of recognize human carcinogens, probable human carcinogens. And if we were to accept that even just those compounds are the primary cause of 80% of cancers that are thought to relate to environmental origins, I think we would still be scraping the surface. The bottom line is that we are exposed to this very, very complex group of mixtures that play out on a very diverse range of genetics, each of us carrying a different genetic profile, mm-hmm. each with individual susceptibilities, each that are in turn affected by our environments. The more we understand about epigenetics, the more we realize that even the genetic code with which you are born is itself being altered by its interaction, the particular sequence of methylation, of histone modification that's occurring through the interaction with the environment, that is playing out in different ways. So, you know, your genes may load the gun, but it is your environment that pulls the trigger. And if we look then at the particular testing that is done, you know, we are in a peculiar situation now where the world's number one herbicide, in fact, the world's number one pesticide that happens to be a herbicide in the form of Roundup, is now jumping up the rankings on the IARC list, and it's glyphosate, the key ingredient in Roundup, that of course fell off patent in 2015, mm-hmm. and of course they're altering it slightly so they can now renew the patent to other forms of glyphosate, but that is now recognized as a probable carcinogen. probably the most interesting development there is that we're now seeing that some of the adjuvants within the Roundup formula, which has also effectively gone generic and different people doing different things with it, but these particular compounds that facilitate the entry of glyphosate into plant cells are themselves up to 1,000 times more toxic now
than the glyphosate itself. Yes.
So, you know, we're really in a position where we're contemplating that the agrochemical companies are engaged in a fairly sophisticated system of adulteration of pesticides, because they know that the particular revolving door that they have with the regulators only requires that the active principles are tested for. But of course, we're not exposed only to active principles. We're exposed to these complex mixtures that involve what we typically think of as inert ingredients that are inactive principles. We now discover that some of these so-called inactive principles are highly active to the extent that they can be more active. Now, you imagine that we are on a daily basis exposed to around about 20,000 different industrial chemicals. Exactly how they play out on our genes is really not known. The one really important thing that we are beginning to understand is that if we can reduce our overall exposure, we like to think of the concept of total synthetic chemical load, if we can reduce our total exposure and we can support our intrinsic, our detoxification systems that are hugely complex. They deal with a mass of different chemistries that we produce ourselves as part of our normal metabolism. They also deal with a huge complex of chemistries that we're exposed to from our natural environment. Plant compounds are often quite toxic. The irony is that that toxicity within the plant compounds are things that we are extremely well adapted. We have evolved over eons to be adapted to them. And so we have lovely phase 1, 2, 3 detoxification systems or biotransformation systems that deal with them. You put a new to nature chemical into that mix and our body sometimes doesn't know how to deal with it. So we look at, say, DDT is one of the most ubiquitous human-made compounds. What we find is, in the effort to try and make DDT less toxic and detoxify it and make it water soluble and excreted, our body is actually converted to DDD and DDE that is actually significantly more toxic than DDT. And so we have a handful of examples where we understand these mechanisms. Our concern is that those kind of processes are probably almost more the rule than the exception. And you put it together and you start to see that our total exposure on chemical load is a very real problem, particularly if you have vulnerabilities in your detoxification pathways.
So significant would be the right word to describe the threat from chemicals at this point.
I believe so. Yeah. The most powerful evidence I think we have for why it's so important is that we find at a clinical level, with the clinicians who are reducing people's chemical load, we're seeing huge improvement in people's conditions. And that, I think, is probably the real acid test in terms of the fact that this stuff is important.
Okay, so the flip side of our toxic environment as regards health is, of course, as you described, it's our ability to deal with them. And, as you say, we're built to deal with natural toxins that are in the environment. But nonetheless, they're very sophisticated, these systems, but they can become compromised as well. This is another problem, isn't it? Not only are they new to nature things that we don't know how to handle, but also our basic systems can become compromised through various routes. And now you do talk about that in the chapter in the book. I wonder if you can go into it a little bit about the factors that can drive the breakdown of our own detoxification systems.
Yes, obviously it's not just the liver that does the work. The liver, if you like, is the central factory that deals with an enormous amount of the filtration and biotransformation process. But actually, every cell of our body and even in our bloodstream, there are all sorts of processes that are acting all the time to alter the if you like, the hazardous state of a given compound. If we look, for example, at the antioxidant systems we have, our body has its own endogenous antioxidant system. You have glutathione that is the, if you like, the master antioxidant that we know we can't take very easily, we can't absorb it very well if we take it in supplementary form, but we can enhance the pathways within our body by making sure that we're having enough high quality protein, by making sure we've got enough B vitamins in our system, we can actually produce more of it. And we also now discover, as genetic testing comes online, that a good many of us have compromised detoxification systems. So if you look at glutathione, I myself, one of the reasons I am passionate about the role of environmental chemicals, from a very young age, I found that I was chemically hypersensitive. I find in the last 5 years since we've had access to genetic testing that, along with around about 50% of the world's population, I have a deletion in my GSTM1 gene that is the key producer of glutathione. So I am genetically compromised in terms of that.
Well, you're
capacity.
Saying 50% of the planet is genetically compromised.
It's a
That's
very
scary.
Very common single nucleotide polymorphism.
Wow.
And of course, the way it works is that may be one that your body then can cope with if that's the only particular SNP that you have in your detoxification pathways. The problem is that, you know, like many people, I've got several. And, you know, if you have many and you also then are exposed to significant chemical load, you will often reach a situation where a straw breaks the camel's back. And that, for many of us, is what happened. In my case, I was exposed unwittingly to pesticides in my early 20s. And I became extremely ill as a result of it. The learning process of learning how to become much more chemical-free was something that took years. And, you know, it was one of the ways in which I started interacting with some of the leading integrative medicine doctors as an environmental scientist 30-odd years ago. And many of these doctors, the amazing thing is many of these doctors have, who were at the beginning of their journey in understanding how chemicals interact, when their colleagues at that time, 30 years ago, were saying that anyone who thought that they were suffering a problem as a result of exposure to chemicals had a psychosomatic condition. And
so as it was a starting point, isn't it?
And they should go and see a shrink. So we've moved on a long way. We are still really at the beginning of understanding this phenomenon of chemical overload, but we're starting to track. And frankly, as controversial as it might be, the issue of vaccines for those that claim to be damaged as a result of vaccines, and what we're looking at is temporal association, so an association in time, usually people developing a range of symptoms, postural tachycardia syndrome, for example, being one of them, where they lose their ability to stand up straight and without being very giddy, fatigue and malaise often being associated, often in a very at a very chronic level, with these symptoms often coming on within hours of the vaccine. And while one or two particular cases like that may be coincidence, it's when you start looking at tens, hundreds and thousands of cases that look very similar and where the condition develops within hours. And of course, there's still a tiny minority of the total number of people being vaccinated, but we are only just beginning to look at the fact that those people may have predisposing conditions, particularly through their genetics or past exposures to environmental chemicals, where they're reacting more to the excipients and adjuvants in those vaccine formulas than the actual organism or attenuated organism itself.
Right, I understand. So one question, you know, these deletions, are they something that in your case, you would think you'd inherited these, that they're actually a sort of something we're generating as a species, that the deletions are occurring more and more in subsequent generations? Or is it actually something in your own life experience that's done that?
No, it's certainly something that you've inherited. Now,
right.
the bottom line is that this is one of the bases of natural selection. We have genetic variations all the time.
Mm.
Some of them are more successful than others. And so variations can be beneficial.
Yeah.
They can also be harmful. And by and large, as you look at the pattern, yes, like the BRCA gene, for example, breast cancer, there are going to be some that are generally bad news. But if you know about them, you can adjust diet and lifestyle
to
basically compensate for those deficiencies. And this is...
That's important, isn't it? That's where knowledge is power.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay. So, given the importance of good detoxification pathways and the unavoidable nature of many of the toxins nowadays, I assume you'd advise giving due attention to both minimising the toxins and stimulating healthy pathways. These are strategies we should be involved in both of all the time.
Correct. It's all the two sides of it. One is very much based on your dietary intake, because a combination of antioxidants at one level that are able to undo free radical damage that often is the precursor to damage to DNA that can act as a trigger for cancer, making sure we have this soup of polyphenols, plant-based compounds that act as antioxidants that are able to handle, if you like, cascades of antioxidants is absolutely key. And one of the problems we face in society is that people have been simplifying their diets. They
right.
often eat a limited number of different foods.
Mm-hmm.
When they go into the supermarket, they eat the same foods. Some people program their eating so that on a Monday they always have the same meal on the Tuesday. They may go into the same restaurant. They may go into, you know, the Golden Starches and other places like that that have an incredibly narrow range of plant-based compounds in their foods.
Right.
So, you know, more and more people eating this sort of yellow, starchy food that is massively deficient in the kind of rainbow-coloured fruits and vegetables. We know that, I mean, there are basically six phytonutrient colour groups, the green, red, yellow, orange, blue, black, purple, and white, tan. And what we really advise is that people make sure that they get representatives of all those colour groups. We call it eating a rainbow every day into their mouths on a daily basis. Really important for children, really important for adults, really important for the elderly. At all times of life, this is important. Food is information. You know, if you look at a single vegetable or fruit, on average, there are about 1,000 discrete compounds within that particular fruit or vegetable. We only really know a lot, and of course that even is a relative concept, depending on how much we're going to know 20, 30, 50 years time. But we only know a lot in today's language about a handful of those compounds. So they themselves act as this sea of information. We have this massive complex of metabolic pathways, and you need to feed those kind of plant-based foods into the system to allow our bodies to establish equilibrium. Our bodies want to do this all the time. So the paradigm changes.
You've got to give them the right...
Exactly.
Equipment.
You've got to give the right information that not only allows these processes to work, but also allows genetic expression to work at its optimum, because the food that you put into your mouth through the release of methyl groups through particular methylation pathways in our body act as the principal switches for genes, to switch on genes and turn off genes at the right time and place. And that's why food and lifestyle becomes such an incredibly important process and genetic expression that really ultimately reflects our health status at any given time.
Yeah, that's brilliant, because this is, of course, is our sort of personal empowerment in the face of many situations we can't influence to do with the environment, like the, you know, the air, if we have to be in a particular place, the air is what it is. So to be able to actually build up your own system to be able to cope with that better is great to know exactly how to do that, isn't it?
Correct. Yeah. And, you know, another really important part is to realise that if you look at cancer, heart disease, mm-hmm. diabetes, obesity, all the major chronic diseases, there are a number of underlying conditions that are common to all of
yes.
these. And one of them, obviously, is oxidative stress. And the way in which you manage oxidative stress is you reduce the amount of oxidation agents that you're putting in the body, some of which may come from environmental chemicals. Other ones might come from the wrong types of food
mm-hmm.
or damaged fats, damaged proteins, overcooked foods,
right.
baked foods. So, you know, a lot of the cereals that we seem happy in this modern age to give to our children are, you know, baked at very, very high temperatures.
Yeah.
They may have had whole grains put into them once upon a time, but those whole grains have been so refined
mm.
that they behave in the body in exactly the same way as if you just put sugar into the body. And so their glycemic index is
mm.
sky high.
Mm.
They're also baked in order in such a way that they form through the reaction with the starches, compounds like acrylamide.
Mm.
We then send our kids off to school and we give
great
them
start of the day.
Yeah,
yeah.
And we give them a white bread sandwich
yeah,
and
yeah.
we go and put processed meats in it.
Mm.
Processed meats are now defined by IRC as carcinogens.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. The sodium nitrite, the preservatives that are put in there convert to nitrous or amine compounds in the gut. So we systematically, from a very young age, expose our children knowingly to a very broad range of either probable or human carcinogens. That's even in today's language.
Mm.
And yet, the supermarkets, the governments find that this is perfectly acceptable.
Yeah.
You set up those eating habits in a young child, they will be very, very difficult to undo later in life.
Mm. Mm. Okay, so look, I'd like to try and squeeze in a couple of things which are just sort of the things that are not spoken about that much in serious discussion of environmental toxins at government level, but you deal with them in your chapter. And the first one is that obviously there's a certain amount of safety testing is applied to chemicals, and each one of them is deemed to be at a safe level, and they probably are. Individually, but that's not really the problem here, what are the level of each one. And the other thing that you bring attention to is the fact that in some cases the old sort of adage that the dose maketh the poison, that the more you have the worse it is and a small amount won't do any harm, isn't even true. So those are two quite important things I think that affect the way we look at environmental exposures to toxins.
Yes, I mean one of the reasons that we need to separate out acute toxicity from chronic toxicity
right.
is because if you look at acute toxicity, which is the response of an organism to a single dose, usually measured in a very short time interval,
mm-hmm.
usually 24 hours. Classically, it's been done on laboratory animals. Obviously, there's a major push now against the use of laboratory animals for testing. But that has been the basis by which we loosely think of the toxicity of a given compound.
Okay.
When you look at the chronic toxicity, in other words, the effects on a given organism to repeated exposures over time, which is actually, frankly, the more important route of exposure in terms of how cancer may form, you get a very different picture. And you also need to start looking at what we call delayed toxicity, which is an effect that may be latent for, in terms of a human life scale, 10, 20, 30 years. So when you look at those
okay.
long-term delayed effects that include carcinogenicity, the ability for a compound or a group of compounds to form cancer, mutagenicity, the ability to produce mutations that may in turn often studied in a petri dish situation, but it gives, if you see a compound or compounds with mutagenic potential, it means they have the potential to cause cancer. Mm-hmm. And then the third group is the teratogenic potential, which is the ability to cause birth defects. And obviously, we see now with Zika, very major concerns in this area. And those delayed effects often operate in a very different dose response manner to typical acute toxins. The more we start looking at them, and xenoestrogens, you know, these are synthetic compounds such as BPA found in plastics, used as plasticizing agents, they often work on a very different kind of dose response basis. We use this term hormesis, which is basically where you might see what is, instead of a straight line relationship between increasing dosage and a given adverse response, what you see is a J-shaped relationship. So as you get to a lower and lower concentration, the effect, as you come up the starting point of your J, you can imagine that we're on audio now, so I wish I could draw it for you. But you can get to a situation where the effect at extremely low doses is actually worse than at higher doses, which is why all the real ecotoxicologists, environmental toxicologists working on xenoestrogens are saying, do you know what? There is no such thing as a safe level. So any level. Mm. And of course, when it comes to xenoestrogens, we have a problem because pretty much all the tap water is contaminated, which is why so often we see for cancer patients, one of the first things we try and do because of their relationship with cancer is actually to bring in water filtration systems such as reverse osmosis that actually can remove these xenoestrogens. So yes, we have a pretty complex pattern there. When it comes to the carcinogenic and acute toxicity testing, there are a range of international health authorities that look at these things, the reality is only a fraction of all the compounds that are out there in industrial use or that are put into personal care products have been tested thoroughly, and many of them haven't. And certainly what has never been done is that the effects of mixtures, which of course what we're exposed to on a daily basis, hasn't been looked at. So unfortunately we are party to one of the world's biggest experiments.
Like guinea pigs,
And most of these compounds that we're concerned about really, in evolutionary terms, have been around for just a flick of an eyelid. They've only really been started to be produced in any significant quantity post-Second World War. That is
no time to adapt.
No. Considering that our genome itself is relatively unchanged for the last 20 or 30,000 years.
Yeah. Okay, well, look, I think we're going to have to call it a day there, but that's just a great taster, if you like, of the kind of information that's in your chapter, part of the cancer revolution. So, fantastic. Thank you very much for contributing and for talking to us today.
Thank you, Robin. I know the book's going to be a success and really urge people to get out there and delve into the huge... I'm so impressed. I'm looking at a copy now for the first time in its finished form, and it is a mass of information. I think there's nothing like it on the market, and both for cancer patients and people concerned about the long-term risks of cancer, it is a really important book.
Great, thank you. So, two very different views on the same territory there. But what they have in common is how well-informed they are about the details of their specialities. As always, you can find links to resources related to today's show on the Yes to Life website. Just go to yestolife.org.uk, yestolife.org.uk, and click the link in the left-hand sidebar to Media Centre, and then choose UK Health Radio. To sign up for the mailing list giving the latest publication information on the book, visit thecancerrevolution.co.uk, thecancerrevolution.co.uk. Next week's programme is another delve into detoxification. I shall be speaking to two internationally respected medical directors, Dr. Contreras of the Oasis of Hope Hospital in Mexico and Dr. Rao of the Paracelsus Clinic in Switzerland. I do hope you'll be able to join me again. Bye.